This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Our assessments show that the harvest will be much later this year. And until then, this food assistance is absolutely critical to save millions of lives across the country.
That was Claire Neville, World Food Program spokeswoman in Zimbabwe, on funding to ease food insecurity in the country. Details coming up. Also, African finance ministers will meet Thursday to discuss how to mitigate a looming economic disaster on the continent. And suspected Boko Haram suicide bombers killed 7 people in Cameroon's northern province. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. With the African Union now predicting the continent's economy will contract by 0.8% this year, African finance ministers are scheduled to meet via video conference on Thursday to discuss how to mitigate a looming economic disaster. Simon Marks reports for VOA News from Addis Ababa.
Researchers at the AU now believe the continent will slip into a recession this year due to the impact the coronavirus is currently having on trade, remittances, tourism, and a huge fall in global oil prices. An AU report seen by VOA estimates governments will lose around $270 billion from lost trade. The report, first published by Reuters, also says governments will need at least $130 billion in additional public spending to fight the virus. François Conradi, senior political economist at NKC African Economics, a research firm in South Africa, said via a messaging app that African governments do not have much firepower to fight the impacts of COVID-19.
The only things we can do really, and that's what these negotiations are about, is to try and boost state spending capacity by organizing low-interest loans from multilaterals and maybe private lenders, and then inject that money into the economy in the form of some sort of help. So we're doing that in South Africa. We're giving some tax holidays to employers of minimum wage people, you know, just to try and save those jobs. And then there's some other initiatives to make financing available at low interest to SMEs to try and get them on their feet. It's the kind of thing that'll help companies that are still viable, but it won't do anything for the companies that have seen their markets disappear.
One big task for African finance ministers will be to convince institutions such as the International Monetary Fund and World Bank to suspend or even cancel some of the continent's debt load. But, experts say, most of Africa's debt is owned by private bondholders who may not have political or humanitarian considerations in mind when asked to cancel debt. Yeo Dosina, head of the Economic Policy and Research Division at the AU, was asked what Africa can do to mitigate the economic impact of COVID-19. He spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
You will see some measures that have been taken already by member states, and including Central Bank. We try to narrow down the interest rate and also to provide liquidity to commercial banks so that we can also put some money in the treasury of the enterprises. And also, there are some social measures that some government have been taking out to provide poor, vulnerable people with some resources, how they can buy food to eat, and also how to try and also to purchase medical material and product and medicine to also treat patients that are now sick.
Dosina added that remittances that are an average of $50 billion per year from the African diaspora have gone down since the coronavirus outbreak began. On Thursday, he said, finance ministers will try and reach a common position on how much debt they want to see suspended or cancelled. African governments will also closely watch an OPEC meeting Thursday, where members are to discuss oil production cuts that would help raise prices and help oil-dependent countries such as Nigeria, Angola, and Gabon. While the full effects of the coronavirus still remain to be seen in Africa, cases are beginning to rise in countries such as Burkina Faso and Cameroon, where there are 345 and 650 coronavirus patients respectively. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The coronavirus outbreak in Cameroon, with over 655 confirmed infections, has accelerated a government plan to remove thousands of homeless children from the streets. About 3,000 are to be reunited with their families or receive job training, including orphans and asylum seekers from the neighboring Central African Republic. Mokirwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Henri Nyambi Dikoso, Director of National Solidarity at Cameroon Ministry of Social Affairs, is leading a group of social workers and hospital staff, removing hundreds of children from streets in the capital Yaoundé this Monday morning. Dikoso says they are making sure they screen against COVID-19, which has been spreading in the Central African state.
Les enfants vont pouvoir être auscultés, notamment en ce qui concerne la prise de la température.
He says they are taking body temperatures so that the Ministry of Health, which is their partner in the operation to clear children from the streets, can start taking care of suspected COVID-19 cases. He says they are also making sure that street corners where the children lived are disinfected and the children are washed to stop the risk of infections. 17-year-old Safia Jamila is among the children who have agreed to leave the streets. She says she has been on her own for 3 years, living on donations from well-wishers and on leftover food from restaurants. Jamila says she escaped from their family home in the northern town of Mokolo when she lost her mother and her father brought in another wife who molested her and refused to send her to school. She says she is leaving the streets because she wants to learn how to cook, sew dresses, and do embroidery. She says her dream is to raise money to attend literacy classes so she can read and write. 10 years ago, Cameroon said it had counted 1,000 street children with ages from 4 years to 17 years in the towns of Yaoundé and Douala. The figures increased to over 10,000 when the separatist crisis broke out in the country's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions, and Boko Haram terrorism intensified on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Many asylum seekers also came from the troubled Central African Republic. Cameroon had plans to clear at least 3,000 children from the streets before the end of this year, but the spread of COVID-19 confirmed in 655 of its citizens in about a month has forced officials to begin removing them from the streets earlier than planned. Marie-Thérèse Abenaontua, Cameroon's Minister of Women's Empowerment and the Family, says parents in particular and communities in general should save the lives of the children by clearing them off the streets.
Ce que nous faisons de demander aux parents d'assumer leurs responsabilités. Il faut qu'il y ait une stabilité au sein de la.
She says they are asking parents who want their children back home to assume their responsibilities by assuring that there is family stability and rigor. She says the government will be giving either education or job training to orphans, asylum seekers, and those who refuse to be reunited with their families. Ondua said high levels of poverty, conflict, family disunity, and a high rate of divorce, illiteracy, rural exodus, and early marriage were responsible for the increasing number of street children. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News. Yaoundé.
After 1 week of national lockdown, South Africa has announced a massive COVID-19 testing program. The government will send thousands of health workers to homes to perform the tests. However, as Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, there are doubts the country is ready for this effort, given the snail's pace at which the testing process is currently moving.
South Africa's Health Minister Zweli Mkhize has described the current rate of positive tests for COVID-19 as low compared with a few weeks ago. However, He says this is because a few people are being tested.
We're going to be increasing the numbers of field workers who are going to be doing the testing and tracing. As of last Friday, we're close to just about 5,000 of them, and this number is going to be increased as we use more of the community health workers, nurses, and some of the NGOs.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has given strict instructions on how the testing and tracing should be done to help limit the spread of the virus.
People with symptoms will be referred to local clinics. People who are infected but who have no or moderate symptoms will remain in isolation at home or at a facility provided by government. And those with severe symptoms will be transferred to hospitals.
South Africa faces many challenges in the effort to contain COVID-19. Millions of citizens who live in informal settlements and highly populated townships share public taps and toilets with neighbors. Nyoki Mabasa, a resident of the densely populated Alexandra Township in Johannesburg, says she now lives in fear after her neighbor tested positive for COVID-19. Mabasa says they use the same toilet and water tap that he uses. She says they have been exposed and she prays that they are still negative. There also is the question of whether the country's laboratories will be able to speedily process millions of samples that will be collected during the massive testing program. As of this week, the National Health Laboratory Service has done only about 6,000 tests since the first COVID-19 case a month ago. Private laboratories have done about 38,000 tests in the same period. Some experts blame the low test count on the polymerase chain reaction, PCR technique, currently being used. In this technique, a sample is collected from the person's throat or nose and sent to the laboratory. It takes up to 4 days to get results, and each test costs up to $75. There are now calls to process tests with the gene expert machines already used for tuberculosis testing. Experts say the smaller version of these machines can be carried in mobile testing vans and produce results in 45 minutes. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The United Nations says it needs $21 million to ease food insecurity in Zimbabwe as the country deals with measures imposed to stop the spread of the coronavirus. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the government says it is going to release funds to help people most affected by the COVID-19 lockdown, such as the old and the unemployed.
In a recent analysis, United Nations experts said 45% of Zimbabwe's rural population is either in crisis or emergence mode in terms of food security. The analysis said the situation is likely to worsen with the coronavirus pandemic. The World Food Programme is stepping in to try to ease the impact. Via WhatsApp, Claire Neville, the WFP spokeswoman in Zimbabwe, said the UN agency has increased the number of food distribution points to limit overcrowding and distributed protective clothing, among other hygienic measures, to curb the spread of the disease. But Neville says the WFP needs more funding.
In order to continue providing vital food assistance to almost 4 million vulnerable Zimbabweans in the context of these new critical health and safety measures, WFP requires an additional $21 million for the next 6 months. This funding shortfall is on top of an already existing gap of $130 million faced by WFP Zimbabwe for the next 6 months. Our assessments show that the harvest will be much later this year. And until then, this food assistance is absolutely critical to save millions of lives across the country.
On Wednesday, Zimbabwe Minister for Social Welfare, Paul Mavima, said while the WFP will mainly feed the rural population, the government will give cash to vulnerable people in urban areas affected by the 21-day lockdown, which started Monday.
The new vulnerabilities as a result of loss of income. Really, the new cash transfers are for urban areas. We are estimating that initially we may be getting about a million people in these urban areas, but we'll review as we go along.
Since the start of the lockdown, vendors have been asking for the Zimbabwean government to compensate for the lost revenue. 38-year-old Patience Rugare, who usually runs a store selling second-hand clothes in Harare, says she needs immediate assistance. Rugare says that when this lockdown started, she had no food in stock as she lives hand to mouth. We are going to die of hunger as we are just seated at home, she says. She adds, I wish they would assist us with cash so that we can survive. The United Nations says Zimbabwe's food insecurity is caused by a combination of recurring droughts and a moribund economy. Fortunately, the country has seen only one death from coronavirus so far and only 8 confirmed cases of the virus overall. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
The United Nations reports the presence of the coronavirus in Sudan is forcing a radical change in the way humanitarian aid and services are being delivered to millions of people in need of assistance. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
In an effort to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in Sudan, the government in Kinshasa and UN agencies are implementing a series of social distancing measures. They include an overnight curfew, the closure of schools, and staff reductions in some key government offices. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports 9.2 million people in Sudan need humanitarian aid, including nearly 3 million refugees and internally displaced people. New ways of delivering aid are being implemented to protect them, as well as international aid workers, from becoming infected by this deadly virus. For example, OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says 2 to 3 months of food rations will be distributed at one time to prevent the spread of COVID-19 by limiting the frequency of large gatherings of people.
To reduce possible risks of exposing malnourished children, there will be an increase in the supply of ready-to-use therapeutic food, which will reduce the frequency of visits by health staff in nutrition centers. Also, new guidelines and procedures are being developed to make sure that health workers can continue to deliver immunization, nutritional supplements, and maintain infant and young child feeding programs in this new reality.
Gender-based violence is a big problem in Sudan and likely to worsen as the humanitarian crisis deepens. In keeping with the new social distancing policy, Laerke tells VOA that various activities involving large gatherings of people have been suspended. These include training workshops and meetings on gender violence awareness.
However, and that's important, of course, individual case management and individual counseling and referrals, for example, to health facilities, and what they call GBV, gender-based violence confidential corner services, so where women can speak in confidence to counselors, that continues.
There is limited information on the exact number of sexual and gender-based violence cases across Sudan. However, a 2014 survey suggests 34% of women aged 15 to 49 are victims of domestic violence. The UN reports very few clinical and specialized psychosocial support and counseling services are available in Sudan to help victims of rape and other forms of sexual and domestic abuse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Recently, the U.S. Military Africa Command, known as AFRICOM, announced it will start issuing quarterly reports by the end of the month on allegations of civilian casualties inflicted by U.S. drone strikes in Somalia. Since President Donald Trump took office, the U.S. military has escalated its drone war in Somalia, targeting militants from the Al-Qaeda-linked rebel group Al-Shabaab. AFRICOM says only two civilians have died in these attacks, but independent watchdog groups say the number of dead is much higher. For more on America's drone war in Somalia, VOA's Jason Patinkin in Washington spoke to investigative journalist Amanda Sperber, who has been researching U.S. military activities in Somalia for the past 3 years. Sperber spoke from Nairobi, Kenya.
So as far as we know, the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes in Somalia since 2007. Since President Trump was elected, there was a spike starting in 2017. And this year, I think there have been almost as many in total so far this year as there have been last year. Nobody's entirely sure of the reasons for why they've spiked so much, but people have very much taken notice because it's been so extreme. The strategy before Trump was that targeted airstrikes would disrupt the structure of militant organizations. So if you take out some key people, the group or wings of the group would crumble. Under Trump, it seems to have gotten much more aggressive and much more indiscriminate, but we have seen that strategy has hugely backfired. As one Somali woman who lived in a village where airstrikes happen pretty regularly told me, if there's a fire in the grass and you stamp it out in one place, it pops up somewhere else.
How have these increased drone strikes backfired?
So the strikes have generated sympathy from the community for Al-Shabaab. They've made Somalis that live in Al-Shabaab-controlled territories distrust their government, which is very publicly hand-in-hand with the Americans. And as far as I know, has not spoken out against any allegations of civilian casualties. It also sets up situations where Al-Shabaab turns on people and accuses them of spying, so it makes things more dangerous for people that live in Al-Shabaab zones.
Can you give a basic idea of how many civilians may have been killed by these drone strikes?
AFRICOM has come out and admitted two civilian casualties in one drone strike incident in 2018. The numbers that everybody else has are incomparable to what they've admitted. Air Wars, which is a civilian harm tracking organization, estimates that between 70 and 150 civilians have been killed by U.S. airstrikes. Amnesty International came out with a new report with evidence that AFRICOM killed two civilians and injured three more in February. Not including that report, Amnesty has documented six cases where airstrikes are believed to have resulted in civilian casualties, killing 17 people. It's an open secret that civilians are dying and being extremely negatively affected by the American airstrikes.
Looking at the U.S., what's it been like trying to get information from them?
If you come to AFRICOM and say, I talked to five people, I have photos that show this person was a civilian, this is his ID card, this is his employer, they'll just sort of say, we can't say more because of security reasons, basically imply that they know something that nobody else knows. That's sort of the wall that they've created.
So basically, you've actually gone to AFRICOM, the U.S. military's Africa command, and shown them photographs and shown them ID cards.
Yes, and I've also given them contact information for family members that they've never contacted. As far as we know, AFRICOM has not reached out to any family members, even when the information is provided to them. There are many family members who are extremely eager, who speak English, to have conversations with them.
There's this new policy where AFRICOM is saying that it's going to do more reporting about the impacts of their airstrikes. What do you make of this new policy?
It's a welcome development. There seems to be some implicit recognition there that more transparency is needed. I'm curious about how it will go. The investigations themselves don't become more substantive. It's sort of hard to see that the reports would have any real significance.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And on behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, I'm Yeheyis Wuhib in Washington, thanking you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.